I hope that people can see impact investing as a spectrum. There is a space for highly attractive financial returns and also good, respectable impact. But if you do want to tackle maybe some of the more intractable problems in society or with the environment, maybe you can't expect a market rate of return. There needs to be a spotlight on a lot of the most commercially attractive solutions. But then also, I don't think we can just sweep under the rug all of the other problems, challenges that don't make tons of money just because of that reason.
Welcome to Brave. Learn from Southeast Asia's best tech leaders. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. No BS on success. I'm Jeremy Au, venture capitalist, Sierra founder, Harvard MBA, science fiction nerd, and dad of two daughters. Every week, we debate startup news, interview changemakers, answer listener questions, and share personal insights. Join our movement of over 40,000 members and get transcripts, resources, and community at www.bravesea.com. Stay well and stay brave. Grain is an online restaurant that serves healthy yet tasty meals on demand and catering. They are backed by investors including the Lo & Behold Group, TE Tia, Open Space, and Cento Ventures. Their meals are thoughtfully created by chefs with wholesome ingredients. For the month of April, Grain has teamed up with HGH Maimuna to bring you a quirky yet delightful experience for the first ever Michelin-inspired catering in Singapore. Learn more at www.grain.com.sg. If you ever need to feed your teams or family, go check out Grain. Hey, I'm really excited to have you on the show. I think it's really inspiring what you're doing in the region. Slightly different tech than all the VCs out there, but I would love for you to introduce yourself.
Hi there, Jeremy. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me to be on your show. Hi to all of the audience as well. Real pleasure to be here today. Okay, so a quick intro. I guess I would be what you would call an accidental investor. Actually, if you asked me that question, what do you want to be when you grow up? When I was younger, I would have said, I wanted to become a diplomat, be at the UN, something to do with an international NGO. This was at that time to be my calling in life, as things often don't go the way you plan. And as we were joking before, I fell off the train and ended up first working at Bain, then finding my way into development consulting and then impact investing. So geographically, that journey has taken me from Australia, where I grew up, to India, and then for the last to Vietnam, which is my adopted home. And yeah, I guess today what I do is I'm the CEO and co-founder of the Beacon Fund, which is a private debt fund. So not VC, as Jeremy alluded to, but yep, a private debt fund that focuses on what we call the missing middle of entrepreneurs in Southeast Asia.
Awesome. We'll definitely get into that. So what were you like as a kid? Because you were really into this community service and national representation from what I can tell. What were you like as a kid?
Yeah, that was interesting question. I would say I had really like a gift of a childhood, very stable childhood. I lived in the same house, went to the same school for basically my entire formative years. Hi, I have what you would call hippie Asian parents. They're not your typical tiger mom and dad at all. Rather than telling me like, you need to study more, get A+, et cetera, they're like, hey, Shigen, you need to get out more. Have you thought about taking a walk, seeing your friends? So interesting. And I'm not sure whether any of our listeners in Asia can relate to that on the call, but I have to say I'm extremely blessed to have a very cool, cooler than me parents that I do have. Maybe two things to know about me when I was growing up. I think number one was I was not entrepreneurial or business oriented at all. In terms of some of my friends, they have all of these great stories about starting their first business at age 10 and making more than their mom and dad. No, that was not me. I didn't really have an entrepreneurial bone in my body. Maybe I did, but it was yet to be discovered at that time. The second point I would say, which yeah, maybe interesting now that I look back at it, was that I was maybe even painfully, my parents always tell me the story once we were over at a family friend's house and then they had a kid about my same age. And then he had to wave his hand in front of my face. And does she talk? Because I was that quiet. And yeah, I guess in my own shell. And I mean, that's been an interesting journey because as to start a fund, you have to really be out there. And I think I've had to somehow dredge up from inside myself that kind of extroversion qualities and sales qualities that one needs to have.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that you went on to become a consultant at Bain, which I also worked at. So what was that experience like?
Yeah. Gosh. So basically, how did I end up at Bain? As I said, it was my dream to join, say, the Australian Public Service. Unfortunately, I think many good things that happen in life, right? It was one rejection right there because I didn't get a job. I didn't get even called to an interview. That leads to another wonderful door opening. And for me, that was getting the chance at Bain. I mean, it was definitely a bit of a baptism of fire. Before I started at Bain, I had literally never opened Excel. I thought that was a little, why did you put this kind of equal sign first at the start of every, like everything you put into Excel? This was the level of my knowledge at the time. But with it at a place like Bain, you either learn or you do not last there very long. And I guess being in some ways, I did learn and challenge myself and got up to speed. This was corporate Australia maybe 15 years ago. I would say it was a bit challenging for me when I didn't see as many leaders who really kind of looked like me, had the same story as me. So it did raise some questions about that, I would say. But I think overall, I can't think of a better place to build a lot of fundamental skills that still help me to this day. So I'm not sure whether that, what your reflection is on your time at Bain and the gifts that it gave you.
I think what jumped out at me is that you definitely co-led Aurora, which is the pro bono consulting group. Then you later went on to also consult with TechnoServe, which is also, you know, pro bono strategy consulting project. So what was that experience like?
Yeah, as I've shared, impact was always very close to my heart. Bain was a stepping stone to something else, like it is for many people, right? I think many people that I started Bain with didn't necessarily, some did want to become like a Bain partner. That was their goal in life. I think many, they saw it as a stepping stone like I did. So I think for me, even while I was at Bain, I did want to get as much impact or nonprofit experience as I could. Unfortunately, I would say when I was at Bain, because of the working hours and so forth, it was hard to maybe explore that as fully as I would truly want to. But I think in small ways, we were able to support local nonprofits in Australia. And I began to see maybe how a more generic consulting skill set could actually be applied to problems that personally I felt more passionate about and interested in. So these questions of social impact and serving underserved communities. The turning point, I would have to say, was one of the great things about Bain was that, you know, you get to take this transfer. And I went to New Delhi in India. And that was definitely a moment when I was like, there's a whole other side to the very quiet, sleepy suburb of Sydney that I grew up in. And I fell in love with that kind of emerging markets energy. And basically since then, been living in Asia, emerging markets. I think it was also the catalyst for me to say, okay, Bain, I've really had a great experience. I've used it as that stepping stone, but now is time to branch out and get back to my original calling. So soon after that transfer experience in the New Delhi office of Bain, I decided to leave. And that was, so TechnoServe, for those of your audience who might not have come across it before, it's a development consulting firm. So on one half of the firm, or you have people from MBB or JP Morgan, investment bankers, this type of thing. And then on the other half, you have amazing development, I guess who I had wanted to be, those hardcore development professionals who know a lot about agriculture or workforce development or topics such as that. And it was a beautiful thing to see what happened when you put these two groups or different types of people together. On one hand, some pretty idealistic, I would say, ex-consultants and bankers, and then people who frankly had a lot more real experience than us solving the most intractable problems. So TechnoServe, I was also living in India, doing a really interesting project in the agriculture space, basically asking ourselves the question, we're working with a large donor, and how do we increase the livelihoods or increase the incomes and improve the livelihoods of smallholder farmers in Bihar and Orissa, which are two of the poorest states in India. I think learning from that experience, I was like, okay, some of the skills that I learned at Bain are actually applicable to these types of issues as well. I think that logical thinking, the framework, all of that is pretty applicable, I would say. And then I also realized I do have a lot to learn about consulting. It can be quite high level and it is by definition strategic. So I did have a lot to learn about what it really meant for, say, a small farmer producer organization in Bihar to deliver fertilizer in a very practical way. And no amount of beautiful slides or aligned footnotes could really get myself out of that, contribute to that dilemma. It was a good both wake-up call as well as another catalyst, I would say, in what I decided to do next.
Yeah. And what you did next was join the venture capital slash, well, venture philanthropy side with LGT, with Earnly and Forbes.
Yeah, exactly. At that time, I was basically a consultant, right? I'd done strategy consulting and then I'd done development consulting. Then I heard about this very interesting idea called impact investing. So these days, everyone knows about impact investing. I think everyone wants to become an impact investor. Back then, it was still pretty new and quite niche, I would say. But through, I guess, the network and circles that I was in, I did hear about it. And I was like, this is very cool. I think as we know, being an investor is, you do have more skin in the game than being a consultant. It's just that's the truth of the matter. And that was really interesting to me. I did want to see things over a longer time period, right? Because I think, again, with consultants, I do genuinely believe add value, right? But it is case driven. It's 6 months, you come in and then you move on to the next. As an investor, of course, the cycles are much longer, right? I mean, typically, let's say 10 years for most typical plain vanilla type of fund, or even longer, arguably. And I was like, okay, how do things really, because it takes time, right? Especially in these markets. How do I give myself seat, right, at the arena where you can see these things evolve over a longer time period. So I think that was my initial motivation for thinking about investment as the next career path for me. There was a big problem with that, which is that I had zero investment experience and zero deal making experience. So basically, I was pretty open-minded and flexible about where should I go, which firm should I work for, what should I do. And I think the other big piece of it for me was that the impact aspect. I think I did always intentionally want to work for an impact investing firm, not necessarily say more mainstream VC or private equity. So that did limit down the options a little. And that's how I ended up at LGT. And yeah, I'm very grateful. I think that they gave me that opportunity, brought me to Vietnam, which has again been maybe another turning point in my own experience. And I started from the ground up, really learning the basics, deals, term sheets, due diligence. As I said, I had no deal experience going to the job, but that was 11 years ago now, basically. And I think ever since, I've been so lucky and privileged to see the Vietnam also kind of, let's say, early stage entrepreneurship ecosystem really emerge almost like nothing to where it is today. And I think that's been really the journey of a lifetime.
Amazing. And what's interesting is that you were really at a ground level, like you said, of venture philanthropy, because that was so early back then. I mean, 2013 was really like ground zero. I'm just kind of curious, any myths or misconceptions about venture philanthropy from your perspective? I mean, the field has also evolved a lot over the past dozen years.
Yeah, I think maybe let me comment about, say, impact investing in general, right? Because I think venture philanthropy, that's a whole different debate about, say, the spectrum of capital. But let me talk about impact investing. And I would say it's very interesting. I would say impact investors have a bit of a chip on their shoulder in some ways, right? Because I think since the kind of field began, there's always been tremendous pressure on impact investors to prove somehow that they can deliver good return. What are good returns? That depends on who you ask. But I guess more specifically, I think for a lot of that period, there's been a lot of pressure on impact investors to prove that they can deliver risk-adjusted market rate of return, to use our favorite jargon. And I mean, for the record, I do believe that's possible. I do believe that investing with an impact lens or a sustainability lens, you can achieve those types of outcomes financially. But I think maybe one of the biggest myths in life is that you can always have your cake and eat it too. I think I've seen you talk about trade-offs in other versions of your podcast in different settings, both personal and professional. I think with impact investing, there are trade-offs as well. I think it's quite hard to have amazingly spectacular financial returns, but at the same time, deliver the deepest impact to the most underserved communities. And I hope that people can see impact investing as a spectrum. There is a space for highly attractive financial returns and also good impact, respectable impact, right? But if you do want to tackle maybe some of the more intractable problems in society or with the environment, maybe you can't expect a market rate of return. And I think there has been a little bit more. And I think both sides need spotlighting. I think there needs to be a spotlight on a lot of the most commercially attractive solutions. But then also, I don't think we can just sweep under the rug, right? And especially coming from more of that, let's say, impact-focused, community-driven background, I think we can just sweep under the rug like all of the other problems, challenges that don't make tons of money just because of that reason. I think there's still ways to achieve sustainable returns. I'm not saying that has to be solely the purview of philanthropy or charity, but I find people have sometimes a bit of trouble imagining looking at all the space in between, right? Between charity on the one hand and then all out for profit driven investing. There's a lot of beautiful things in between. Let's look at that more carefully.
And what's interesting is that you continue to explore this further because you went on to start at Patama Capital, right? And there's been 9 years of your journey as well, and also doubling down on Vietnam as a geography. Could you share more about that move?
Yeah, I think Patama was, I think, where I've spent most of my professional career. And yes, and I guess this is where I am a bit relevant for your podcast, and that I did work at Impact VC for the time that I was focused on Patama's venture capital. Again, I think it was 9 years ago, right? So still at that time, venture capital ecosystem was very early in not just Vietnam, but Southeast Asia. Again, I'm sure your readers know that extremely well. I think it was interesting. A lot of our impact thesis at the time was focused on, hey, we are backing entrepreneurs who are serving low and lower middle income consumers. And believe it or not, that was actually quite a revolutionary idea back then. Of course, nowadays, everyone is targeting the mass market. I mean, almost VC firms are like, hey, Southeast Asia is like mass market, right? This is where the money is. But honestly, 9 years ago, when we were talking about low and lower middle income consumers, people were like, this makes no sense, right? How can you build tech companies that focus on this type of segment? So that is maybe one of my biggest, what's interesting reflection on how the market has evolved. And I think for the better, because I think it's a good thing that there is more capital flowing towards entrepreneurs who are really meeting the market where it is. And as everyone says these days, tapping into middle class.
What do you think was the challenge for folks to understand that between poor people versus emerging middle class? What was the gap in that understanding?
Honestly, I think some of it was more repositioning it. I think obviously, poor people, I think it's also a bit of a dismissive term as well. Yeah, it's a bit offensive almost in a way. So I think kind of repositioning it towards more like the aspiring middle class. So maybe it was had a bit of a branding issue. But then people ultimately saw this is where the market is, right? And if you can find a way to capture a portion of this consumer bracket's share of wallet or spending power, then you can build big businesses out of that. And I think it was just all of us getting smarter, right, over time and really seeing that this was a commercial and viable business opportunity. Honestly, I think that's the story of like many things in the impact investing space, right? Something maybe has a bit of a negative connotation and, for example, SMEs, right? I think we can get to that later, but actually, there's money there too, right? And how do you develop the right model to that market and segment? Maybe we have to change.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that you also doubled down and then you went on to co-found Beacon Fund as well. Could you share more about that?
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I love VC. I love tech startups. And as I said, it was a huge part of my formative experience as an investor. I think another thing did become clear to me though, as through all of the conversations that I had with entrepreneurs, with investors, et cetera, around the region. And it was basically the idea that startups are great. They have a lot of potential and I cheer on all of the VCs in this region. I think the challenge is VC is just one tool, funding tool or one funding instrument in a toolkit. Actually, if you look at most companies in our region, they are SMEs. They are not startups, right? They are not high growth tech startups. And this became very clear to myself as well as, the team, I would say, at large, because we would often be turning down investors, even us as impact investors. We would often be turning down companies because we're like, oh, this isn't really like a $1 billion market that you're targeting. Like, sorry. I don't see the potential for this to grow 10x or double in size every year. I mean, these are very common frameworks or heuristics that VCs use to screen through companies. Again, I'm sure all of your listeners are well aware, right? So that was an interesting insight. I mean, maybe it's not very insightful in a way because it's kind of obvious, but it was an interesting prompt for us to think about, like, okay, given a large part of my North Star has always been about providing capital to companies which are underserved, who need it more and the most and are doing very interesting things. How can we think about setting up a fund that really meets their needs? And that was why we settled on launching Beacon, which is a private debt fund, as I said earlier. And you might be wondering, like, debt? Why debt? That sounds bad. Why do that? Many entrepreneurs could be wondering, but actually, I don't say debt is better than equity or debt is better than VC. It depends on every company, every situation. And frankly, it's often a mix of the two that can take companies to where they want to go. But there isn't much debt apart from bank loans in our ecosystem, right, or in our environment. Debt is actually an interesting option for entrepreneurs because it allows, it firstly, it takes off that pressure on and exit because it's self-liquidating. So over a 3-4 year timeframe or whatever, the company can repay that debt and you're done, right? You shake hands, you walk away. There's no, oh my goodness, we're at year 9 or 10 of our fund life. We need to get out. What's the plan, right? Which is very frankly, as you know, right? I mean, one of the challenges, tough moments as life as a VC in this region. So I think that's number one. I think there's this piece around exit. I think other companies or other entrepreneurs, it's really around control. I mean, they want to run their business their way. They don't necessarily want to be beholden to that logic or formula of VC, which really demands a certain growth path and expectation and really to hit that, to meet your commitments to your VC investors. So some people just don't want that for different reasons. And I think, again, for this segment of founders, can we do something which really respects that choice? I think the third piece is, I don't come from a finance background, but now I know very well that debt is cheaper than equity. And this is actually, it sounds maybe obvious to anyone who has an MBA or studied finance, but actually that insight is not necessarily commonly accepted. So I think often the responses that we get from founders is like, oh, but like equity is free and like debt, you have to pay it back. Like, why would you want to take on debt? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Probably don't tell your VC that equity is free. So it's, there's still maybe a lot of knowledge sharing, experience sharing that needs to be done around debt as a product. It's just another option. As I say, I don't say debt is better or worse than equity. It's just another option for entrepreneurs, certain entrepreneurs, to consider as they chart their own destiny.
I think these are pretty spot on. I think the challenge for exits in Southeast Asia makes it difficult for that 10-year life cycle and exit structure. So I really agree with you that debt is a good instrument here. And I want to double click what you said, which is founders have that aversion to debt. Why do you think that happens?
I think that's an interesting question. I would say some of it is a bit cultural. I think I'm not sure. I don't know, even for, say, my family or the way that I grew up, I think there's this bit of a stigma attached to, you know, being in debt or taking out a loan. So I think there is some kind of stigma there, I have to say. Maybe that's more in the personal context, but in some ways that's been transferred to business because frankly, like most all large companies in the world, like Apple, Google, like everyone uses debt. So in some way, I would say it's maybe a bit Asian culture. I think the second piece is that, yes, I think it definitely does enforce certain kind of discipline around, or it does require a certain type of discipline around cash flows, financial management, and so forth. I'm not going to lie. I think that is, when you do take on debt, you do have to pay it back according to a fixed schedule. And there are consequences, of course, if you do not. Of course, I think debt investors would, you know, I'd like to think are not loan sharks, but frankly, that is even some of the gap or hesitation on the part of some entrepreneurs. Yeah, so I think cultural, maybe stigma. I think secondly, this need for like very extreme or very disciplined kind of financial management. And I think three, there have been some bad actors in many of these markets where quite an active black market or less than informal market in lending perhaps has again turned people off. I think in the early days, we had to do a lot to convince people that we're actually a very credible like institutional investment fund, right? Not something that we're running in the back streets or something like that. So I think those maybe are some of the reasons why I would say it hasn't taken off in our region.
And as you deploy, you know, more and more debt over the past couple of years into Southeast Asia, what are some non-obvious principles or things that you're looking out
for? Yeah, it's interesting. I would say, I think one is it's quite challenging to find companies in that exact sweet spot of what we're looking for, in the sense that you want a company which has good cash flows, some track record of generating cash flow, but not too good. Because obviously, if they were so fantastic, then they wouldn't need you. On the other hand, you would like to avoid companies who are in a more needy or, let's say, sometimes even kind of more cash-strapped type of situation, because those types of investments, that's more like special situations lending, right? Which is frankly something that we do not do. I think the returns on that also can be quite attractive, but I think not necessarily, like we lend to companies that are performing well. So I think to find companies that are in that sweet spot of they need you, but then they're not too desperate. Is this an interesting balance that needs to be found? I think the second maybe learning that we had was, maybe this is a very interesting one. I learned that the level of due diligence that was required as a debt investor was in some ways next level to what I did as a VC. And I don't say, you're looking for different things. I don't say this to criticize or throw stones, not at all. But the level of due diligence and scrutiny that we had to put on ultimately cash flow from operations of these these companies was at a whole different level than we did at VC. I mean, in VC, as we're not really looking at the financial model. Of course, something is submitted to us. We look at the projections. They show a nice hockey stick going up and up. At some point, the company breaks even, but it's much more about the founder. It's about the fundamental product, like innovation that's occurring in that company. That's, at least from my own experience of it, that was the focus of, let's say, VC investing. But debt investing is quite different. I think it's very, I think, equally focused on the people that we're backing. I would say, again, at the end of the day, you want to work with the right people, whether that's in debt or equity investing. But I think the level of financial scrutiny, I think, was at a different level to what we were doing in VC.
Yeah. And could you share a personal story about a time that you've been brave?
Wow. So that's the theme of this podcast, right? It's interesting. I did think about this, and like I didn't think of myself as a brave person, maybe even until this day. But then people always say to me, like, oh, wow, you moved to India by yourself when you were 25, right? That's quite brave. And then, you know, you did XYZ things, right? You started your own fund. Like, I mean, these seem to be times that you were brave. So I guess in some ways, maybe I'm brave. I think that the time where I took maybe the biggest leap of faith, I would have to say, is really starting a new fund. I was chatting to a friend in the investment world, and I think she said something very interesting to me. And I was like, oh, that's kind of true. She said, being a good partner at, let's say, a VC firm is quite different from being the managing partner or CEO of a VC firm or an investment. And I was like, oh, yeah. And when I was reflecting back on my own experience over the last 10, 11 years, I was like, wow, then that is true, because I went from being, I'd like to think, a pretty good partner at Padma. And there the role was focused on good companies, investing in them, and that. And I think the mindset shift, the shift that happened when I started Beacon was like, oh, wait, that part of the experience, finding some good companies and investing in them, is just one small fraction of what it means to run a fund. I mean, at a very basic level, right? I mean, there's fundraising, right? Like, how do you keep the money coming in? I mean, how do you keep the lights on? There's the whole fund management operations aspect of it. Building a team in a different way. So I didn't honestly realize it at the time. I'm not sure that I was being very brave at that moment, but I think looking back now, at that shift from, okay, it was pretty comfortable, honestly, like was a partner at a, you know, Impact VC firm, got my paycheck every month, and took some risks from a financial perspective at that time, but also a career path. Maybe it's not going to work out. Maybe it still won't work out. I guess that's life. But I think that was maybe that leap that I would say has been, I think, brave, but then also I think that's where the rewards come. I also grew a lot, and I would say was able to empathize with entrepreneurs a whole different way, because I think I had much, you know, you do have P&L responsibility in the end if you run what I do have now. And boy, have I grown up.
What does it mean to have grown up from your perspective?
For me, it means, I think there is one thing that really does spring to mind. And I think for me, it's taking responsibility. I think this idea of almost radical self-responsibility. Honestly, in the past, I used to parcel out, I wouldn't say, I mean, blame is a bit negative, but responsibility, let's say, to a situation, or it's more like this person's responsibility, etc. Now, I think, yes, exactly. Now, and having that experience of my own business in a way, I mean, even though it is a fund, everything is like the buck stops with me 100% of the time. You can't say, oh, this investment didn't work out because somebody else led it or somebody else approved it. No, like it's all you, or that the team dynamic isn't working in this particular area. Like I created that. And it sounds, I don't know, it sounds like self-flagellating in a way. Everything's your fault. No, it's not about that. I think it's recognizing your responsibility. I think this great saying, I read it in a book called Reboot. I don't know whether you've read it, but it really encouraged us. Yeah, it's like the question that he asks is, how are you complicit in creating all of these situations that you say you don't want? And that was like all of these situations that I complain about or whinge about. I created them, right? Maybe, or I let myself sit in that situation. And I think it's a journey, and I'm not sure that you ever graduate from this, but I think realizing that it's on me, right, in the end, to either change the situation or get out. And I think it's helped me become a lot happier and also improve the relationships that I have, because I'm no longer, it's not about blaming others or blaming situations, but about working through things together. So I think that was growing up.
Amazing. I love that so much. So on that note, I'd love to summarize the three big takeaways I got from this conversation. First of all, thank you so much for sharing about what it was like to grow up as you, looking to save the world and really taking those steps along the way in government service, being rejected from government service, to working at Bain, to kind of like working in frontier and emerging markets, all the way to venture philanthropy. So really interesting to see your navigation and your staircase to figure out where you want to be and how you want to be. Secondly, thank you so much for sharing sharing about how you think about Southeast Asia, not just in terms of venture capital, but in terms of debt, your approach to it, how you think about the exit markets, but how you wanted to play a part in it in terms of focusing on not just Vietnam, but also on debt as a vehicle. And I thought that was a very good snapshot on how to think about that. It is cheaper than equity in many ways, but there are cultural aversions and roadblocks for it being adopted. But that's changing, especially as you look to deploy more and more into companies that fit the bill. Lastly, thanks so much for sharing about radical responsibility. I thought it was fantastic to hear about you thinking through about how one is complicit in the situations that you end up yourself being in. And I thought it was fascinating to hear that you really exemplified that courage at every stage of your career in terms of changing roles, changing geographies, and setting up your own fund as well. So on that note, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. We would also appreciate you leaving a rating or review. Head over to www.bravesea.com for member content, resources, and community. Stay well and stay brave.